Can you make sure I...
Is this working okay on here? Good. And get this one. All right, and this is gonna be the change. Looking to figure out which button does which. Maybe, okay, good. I have no commercial disclosure. I'm gonna talk primarily about our current knowledge, some items that won't necessarily be used in your clinical practice, but you should be aware of. One of these is the knowledge of the pathophysiology of type 1 diabetes and some diabetes prevention trials that are presently in place through the National Institutes of Health. I'll also talk a little bit about the use of designer insulins that have become available the last 10 to 15 years and give you some idea of how we use those in pediatrics. And then I'd like to give you a little bit of an update on emerging technologies that will come available in the future for treatment of type 1 diabetes. So diabetes, pediatric diabetes is important because the incidence is actually increasing by 3% per year. And of note is that the greatest increase is occurring in children less than 5 years of age. Diabetes has a major impact on a child's life, particularly in terms of having to follow a specific protocol, and has a major behavioral component. And then finally, we know now that there are potential for much better outcomes than historically. So blood glucose control does equate to a healthier, longer life. And we've already seen that in the fact that patients with complications of type 1 diabetes are significantly lower than in young adults now than they have been in the past. This is some information, and oops, wrong way. How about a pointer? I won't point. So this shows the incidence of, or the number of cases of type 1 diabetes diagnosed at Primary Children's Medical Center since between 2002 and 2012. That incidence has increased from 200 to 270 during that time, so that's about a 3% increase per year, similar to what's reported in a number of studies throughout the world, really. The pathology that occurs is autoimmunity. Our T cells and B cells enter the pancreatic islet and destroy those, so that the darker colored cells are the inflammation, and the pink cells are the remaining islet cells, including the beta cell. So eventually that whole islet gets replaced by inflammation, and there are no insulin producing cells there. We can actually follow the progression of type 1 diabetes in family members who have been tracked over time, and we know that when that inflammation starts, the B cells begin to make antibodies that can be detected. And these antibodies can be used to predict that the individual will progress to diabetes. We can also measure glucose levels 2 hours following oral glucose tolerance test, and we get some sense of the health of the beta cells themselves. Blood glucose less than 140 is considered a relatively, at 2 hours is abnormal, but is not considered a high risk. Blood glucose above 140 is considered a higher risk individual. And then the last point from this slide is that when we treat diabetes initially, though there are that 10 to 20% of cells that are still left from the autoimmunity recover and give us this honeymoon period of diabetes. And then as the autoimmune process progresses, we lose that function. And one note is we'd love it even if we could preserve the honeymoon, and we'll talk just briefly about a couple of studies that have been done in that respect. So this slide shows that once an individual develops two or three diabetes or beta cell autoantibodies, they have a 50% or greater risk of developing diabetes over the next 10 years. And the way we look at this is that these individuals and this is what's been used to design prevention studies. There is a genetic risk that involves being a member of a family. There are a half dozen genes or more that contribute to this. But once an individual in the family has that, it's known that they'll have a higher risk for developing diabetes. The largest risk comes from the HLA locus, and that gives 50% of the risk of type 1 diabetes. So we can actually identify siblings at risk, even at birth, if they share HLA identical with an older sibling, they have a 50% chance of developing diabetes by age 15. The other way to look is to look at this time when the antibodies develop, when there's still maybe significant amount of beta cells present, and to see if we can design some intervention to turn around the autoimmune process. And then once we see impaired glucose tolerance, we could consider maybe getting a little bit more aggressive because we know these individuals have a greater than 50% chance of developing diabetes within 5 years. And then finally, the last thing that's been done is at least a half a dozen studies using various immune agents that are used in other autoimmune conditions that are effective in those conditions to try to prolong the honeymoon phase of diabetes. And I'll mention those results just briefly. So the type 1 diabetes, the risk can be determined by the HLA genetics, by the presence of IL antibodies, and by a 2-hour oral glucose tolerance test. This is part of a national trial called the Type 1 Diabetes TrialNet Consortium. They have made several attempts to prevent or delay diabetes and have had limited success. So as I mentioned, the early interventions in individuals with new onset diabetes have increased the honeymoon, prolonged the honeymoon, but the disease has progressed once the medication was discontinued. So it's not possible to reverse that inflammation, but maybe just slow it down. There have been some epidemiological studies that suggest that individuals who were first-degree relatives of individuals with diabetes have less risk if solid foods are introduced between 4 and 7 months of age, and so that's a common recommendation within general pediatrics anyway. Early introduction or much later introduction of solid foods may result in some increased risk. Finally, we were part of this type 1 diabetes trial net, so we follow a number of individuals who are identified as having two or three of these antibodies and identified as having a blood glucose less than 140 milligram per deciliter at 2 hours. And these individuals are randomized to an insulin capsule versus a placebo. And those, it was suggested from the initial diabetes prevention trial that this oral insulin may delay the onset of diabetes by approximately 2 years. So in caring for the individual with diabetes, we have to keep in mind the normal physiology, the body produces a basal insulin to just maintain a general anabolic state, and then a bolus insulin at meal times. We have a strong argument for tight control in that these individuals historically, when I did my fellowship around 1980, we had by age 30, we had a large number of patients who already had major complications from diabetes, and we were using MPH and regular insulin, very difficult to manage. In 1993, the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial showed that better control improved outcome. This required the use of glucose meters, which allowed us to really assess what the blood glucose was rather than urinary glucose excretion. And then beginning a little before 2000, and since then, there have been a number of designer insulins introduced that will allow a more physiologic insulin replacement. Finally, we have some, as I mentioned earlier, the decrease in complications in young adults with type 1 diabetes. So whereas I occasionally see an 18 or 19-year-old with renal disease back in around 1980, we, you know, very few individuals get into those problems that early unless they just aren't giving any insulin at all. So these designer insulins have been a big factor. The traditional regular insulin, two insulin molecules form a dimer, and this dimer dissociates slowly so that it has a peak at about 30 minutes to an hour and stays around for six to eight hours. The problem with that is that not only is that insulin there for the meal, but you have insulin around for several hours after the meal. So historically, these individuals had to have frequent snacks to avoid hypoglycemia in between meals. And then the MPH insulin was used for a longer period. Commonly can be used overnight, but again, because of its peak, there was a high risk in children of seizures in the middle of the night. So those were pretty negative aspects. Subsequently, Humalog was the first designer insulin developed. What they've done is make it so that the insulin doesn't dimerize, and as a result, it has a very rapid onset of action and a relatively shorter duration that corresponds to what the food would be absorbed during the meal. And then finally, one of the most useful insulin has been glargine or Lantus insulin, which has a very stable profile and without the peaks that might give you a risk of hypoglycemia. This Detemer insulin is, I'll talk about in just a second here. So these molecules are made by modifying the normal alpha and beta chains of insulin. The insulin lispro and insulin aspart are made by putting charged amino acids in place that inhibit the dimerization of insulin. Insulin glargine is made by adding amino acids that cause the insulin to be insoluble at pH 7, so that when you give an injection of glargine, that vial is at about a pH 5, and then when it is injected in the body, the glargine insulin actually crystallizes and then is slowly released from that crystalline state and gives that long duration of action. And then the Detemer insulin is one that has a 14-carbon fatty acid that allows it to bind albumin, and therefore it's carried around by albumin in a relatively stable state. As you can see, the Detemer insulin with that 14-carbon amino acid has a peak in it. We have had some trouble using it overnight in pediatrics, so we have tended to use the glargine insulin. Novo now has at the FDA another insulin called Degludec, which is, let's see here, it's similar to this Detemer insulin, but the carbon chain is 20 carbons fatty acid, and that insulin, which should become available over the next year or so, has a 36 to 48 hour duration without any peak. So it's another very stable insulin that will be comparable to the Lantus insulin. All right, I better start hurrying here. So NPH gave us these big peaks that were a problem. When we came to basal bolus insulin, we could actually provide better, mimic better what the body normally does. Insulin pump therapy has become available. You know, many times children who are, and families who are newly diagnosed will say, boy, this is, as soon as I can get from shots to pump, I'll be taken care of. But unfortunately, it has the pros that it is more physiologic. You can give multiple doses during the day. Also, microdosing is available, so you can give doses in increments of a tenth of a unit. So in a really small child, you can give a tenth or two tenths, whereas on a syringe, you could guess at a quarter unit. The infusive set it needs to be changed every 3 days as opposed to having 4 to 6 injections a day. It has the advantage that the meter communicates with the pump, also there's software that allows you to download and see exactly what the child is doing as far as giving in some boluses, entering glucose levels, entering carbs. So it gives us a great tool when patients come to clinic to give an idea of what they're actually doing, what areas they're maybe not doing so well as far as the diabetes care. Now, in terms of new options, the biggest area that's new is the fact that over the last 10 to 15 years, continuous glucose monitoring has been developed. There is a glucose oxidase electrode that generates that actually changes according to how much glucose is metabolized by the glucose oxidase electrode, and that's a measure of interstitial glucose levels. This is the first group of these were used to just report historically what blood glucose levels were. Those of you who don't have diabetes, this something would have a blood glucose level, something like this, no matter what activity you had, what you ate, because when you eat, all that glucose that absorbed go right by the pancreas, the insulin's added to it immediately. Someone with diabetes is going to have a lot more variation, and you notice the overnight can be reasonable, but they're also, if the insulin wears off, you'll get a rise in the blood glucose during the night. Of most note on this one is that first morning peak, and you can see even with a blood glucose of 90, and this was in a child whose parents didn't know how much she was going to eat, so they would wait until after she ate to give her insulin. You can see that blood glucose can go from 90 to 100 to 350 in 20 minutes. So we really emphasize giving insulin before the child eats, in 5 or 10 minutes or more if the blood glucose is high, in order to avoid those high excursions in blood glucose. This meter shows you some of the features that are available with continuous monitoring and a pump. There is the little sensor down there in the lower left corner that transmits the reading from the that electrode to the, this is in this case, the pump. You can set alarms in there for high and low blood glucose readings. The individual can actually see in real time or a graph of what their blood glucose has been in the last 6 hours or whatever increment they want to use it in. They'll actually get a number for the current glucose, which has to be, the sensor has to be calibrated twice a day, twice or more a day in order to be sure that those readings are relatively accurate. There is a lag in the glucose levels in the interstitial tissue compared to the blood glucose, so that we have to kind of keep that in account as well. And then finally, the arrows down in the lower right corner there will tell the individual whether their current blood glucose is headed up or down and how fast it's moving, and it will also allow them then to adjust their insulin dosing so they can reduce their dose if that glucose is already headed down, or if it's headed up, they may increase the dose by 10 or 20% either way. So it is a very nice tool. It requires quite a bit of thought on the part of the user, and we really don't use it a lot except in families who are already doing pretty well and want to do a little better. So you can see over a period of use of the continuous monitor from the top to the bottom, that individual is able to really tighten up their blood glucose control using a sensor. So the pros of continuous monitoring are that you can obtain very tight control, that you can have you can adjust the insulin dosing for trends in the glucose, and then you can also set alarms on there for hypoglycemia. And so that is one of the indications for a continuous sensor, is the fact that if an individual has hypoglycemia unawareness, a glucose sensor can be used to set alarms to avoid serious effects of hypoglycemia. The contraindications are that they are difficult to wear. They require the frequent blood sticks, not much less than what you'd be doing without the sensor. Requires close attention and a pretty good knowledge base. You get the alarm going off quite frequently, and individuals who aren't paying attention will just learn to ignore it or turn it off without even looking at what's happening, and it does increase the expense of your diabetes care. So what we hope will happen in the future is that we have something like a sensor linked to a pump and a computer algorithm that would actually have an ability to shut the pump off based on the trend, it predicts that hypoglycemia is going to develop. You could also raise the infusion rate with the glucose timing. And it's only used now in studies and sometimes in intensive care units. The other thing coming down the line would be a second pump with glucagon, which would allow the individual to, or which allow this closed loop system to actually raise the blood sugar by infusing it. Small amount of glucagon. Right now, there's really not a good glucagon solution, and you'd be talking about three sites, one for the sensor, one for the insulin infusion, one for the glucagon. So those are all potential issues at this point. So just in summary, the incidence of type 1 diabetes is increasing. Identifying risk in family members has allowed some prevention studies. Not a great amount of success to this point. Tools for type 1 diabetes care have improved markedly with the designer insulins, and blood glucose control translates into improved health, but it is a lot of work for families, and it's always important to recognize that rather than chewing them out for what they're not doing. And then this CGM may lead to a closed loop and what we'd call an artificial pancreas. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Two questions I have is, one is, what is the significance of sustained moderate elevation of the C-peptides even after they're clinically diabetic? And what is the current status of islet cell transplantation?
Okay. The C-peptide is the little part that's clipped off between the alpha and beta chain. And so it is a measure of endogenous insulin production in the individual, irrespective of what kind of insulin they're receiving. It's been shown that there is a varying levels of C-peptide in individuals with type 1 diabetes, even 20 or 30 years down the line. And that's the reason why it's easier for some individuals to take care of their diabetes than others. Let's see, the second question was the effect or the potential for transplants. Those have been done both. Pancreas transplants have been relatively successful because the individual is already going to go on immunosuppressant for a kidney transplant, so those are done together. The islet transplants that have been done have worked for relatively short periods of time, maybe 2 to 3 years, and then the diabetes recurs. And if they have just an islet transplant, they have to be on the same immunosuppression you'd be on for any other transplant, and therefore, it's not really feasible to do that in kids, to have them on a large number of children on immunosuppressants. Go ahead.
You said a couple of things that made me really worry about little kids at night, diabetic ketoacidosis occurring within 4 hours. I was wondering, would it be useful to add to some sort of monitor for ketones, either in the air around where the little kid was sleeping, for acetaldehyde, or perhaps a blood monitoring for ketones at night, in case he's getting in trouble or something.
And that's a good thought. Usually they won't be in ketoacidosis where they're ready to go to the hospital, but once that process starts, and if the family doesn't recognize that infusion site is working, by the morning or mid-morning, if they keep using the pump where the site is occluded, that child may be ready to go to the emergency room. So that's one of the areas of education that's very important, is for families to recognize if that pump site fails. Thank you.